We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, hour two of the show. Glad to have you with us. My name's David Inge. Harriet Williamson, our producer, Jason Croft at the controls. This morning, in this part of the show, we will be talking about diabetes. Now, from time to time here on the program, we have physicians, and one of the things that we do on a regular basis is this show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor with Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine doctor. He's on every other month. As a matter of fact, next Monday, I think that he's going to be on the show. Last time he was here, we got a number of questions about diabetes, and we thought, well, this would be a good thing to be talking about. Given what we know about the numbers of people who have diabetes, the numbers of people who have it but don't know it, and the fact that it's a kind of a growing problem. So we thought that we could spend some time here talking about the basics and giving folks who are listening the chance to call in with questions. And we have as our guest here this morning, Patricia Reichard. She is a nurse practitioner at Carle. It works in the endocrinology department, and a lot of time is spent working with people who have diabetes, helping them manage their condition, answering their questions, and that's what we're going to do here this morning. So if we can answer questions, we will do that. She'll, I know, do her best. Whenever we have physicians and medical people here on the program, I hope that listeners understand there are some limits as to what we can do because they can't see you and might have to ask some fairly specific questions, but we do these shows to answer questions, add to your basic information, and I know she'll do her best to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you very much for being here.
I'm happy to be here.
You just mentioned in passing, I guess it had escaped us, but that October was National Diabetes Month, so I'm sure that was a time when people were seeing articles in the news and diabetes organizations would be trying to raise people's consciousness. But the fact is, it seems that diabetes is, while it's certainly not something that is new, is a growing concern, particularly for adolescents, for children who are now turning up either pre-diabetic or actually turning up with type 2 diabetes, which is something that it seems like we didn't used to see that in children. We didn't used to see it in teenagers.
That's correct. And some people aren't aware that diabetes is growing worldwide. A lot of times we think of it as being associated with the obesity epidemic in the United States, but it's actually growing even in third world countries. So the causes behind that are not as clear-cut as we might think, and there are probably, you know, multifactorial causes related to that. Yeah. But I just read an article recently that indicated they expect diabetes to triple in the next 30 years, and that's a pretty staggering statistic.
And I suppose part of that might be explained by obesity, because we know that that's one of your risk factors, although it's also true that you could have a thin person, and that person could have diabetes also. So
absolutely.
So there's not a guaranteed sort of one-to-one connection.
That's correct. Generally, type 1 diabetes may be more associated with thin people, whereas type 2 diabetes may be more common in people that are overweight or obese, but that's not always the case.
Well, I tell you, we have a caller already. I will not make them wait. This is someone who is listening over in Indiana. We'll start right in. Line number 4. Hello.
Hello, thank you.
Sure.
Something I've wondered about times, but I've never had the presence of mind to ask my doctor or her nurse when it occurs. But let's say every 90 days she would have a fasting sugar and find out her A1C or something. I was wondering if the A1C changes, say, a tenth, goes from 6.1 to 6.2, whether or not that can be broken down to what your average blood sugar would be if you were taking a test each day. One time I went in, I had a blood sugar of 100 on my machine. That when the test came back by the lab, it was 113, and my doctor says, don't get too upset about that. None of them are accurate. But they're within, you know, a ballpark figure to keep some kind of rein on your, you know, if you go a little crazy at Thanksgiving or Christmas. But I was wondering if there's something like that that can, if somebody say, well, you're doing about 120 a day then, or if there's anything that's, you know, sensible about that kind of question. Thank you.
That's a very good question. Absolutely, there is. There's something called average daily blood sugar. And I don't know what kind of glucometer you're using, but with most glucometers, you can push a button, your memory button, and find your, say, 7-day average, 15-day average, and 30-day average in your glucometer. And that is fairly closely associated with your hemoglobin A1C levels. And there's charts that perhaps you can find in your doctor's office that show the association between your average blood glucose and your hemoglobin A1C. But generally, if your hemoglobin A1C is at 7, your average daily blood glucose is less than 150. Another thing to keep in mind is that the industry standard for glucometer testing, the self-monitoring blood glucose testing that you do at home, states that those glucometers only have to be accurate within about 30 to 40 points. So they're not giving you quite as precise of a reading as your hemoglobin A1C number is. But if you look at the long-term average, say the 30-day average, it does pretty closely correspond with your hemoglobin A1C. It's probably not sensitive enough to tell a difference between a hemoglobin A1C of 6.1 and 6.2, but it will correspond pretty closely with a 1 percentage point difference, say, between 6 and 7 in your hemoglobin A1C.
That seems to be a pretty broad error range. And here we're for people that want to make sure we know what we're talking about. Here we're talking about the little things that you take a device, you prick yourself on your finger, you get a little drop of blood, you have a little meter, you put that drop of blood on there, mm-hmm. and it says, okay, this is what your blood sugar is. That seems like it's a pretty big error spread, 30, 40 points.
It may seem like, but through testing, they've determined that this is close enough, apparently, to make decisions, you know, based on what your blood sugar is. It's certainly not as precise as other devices that are now on the market, such as a continuous glucose monitoring device that you could wear on your body at all times. But it's kind of the best we have at this point. And it does, if you look at the longer term, like the 30-day average in your meter, it does fairly closely correspond with your average blood glucose that would then correspond with your hemoglobin A1C level.
Okay, so over enough spread of time, your error kind of averages out so that you're going to get a fairly accurate reading.
That's right. Okay. Now, sometimes people will come in and they'll ask a question such as, well, I can check my blood sugar and it may be, say, 140, and then I check it, 15 minutes later or right after that, and it's 156, and why is there a difference? And that's just because the glucometer is not that precise. It's only going to be precise, only within about the 30 or 40 points.
Oh, okay. Other questions welcome here. We have somebody ready to go in Savoy. We'll talk with them next here in line number one. Hello.
Hello. Doctor, I had a couple questions that kind of came up from the initial discussion here. First, though, what is hemoglobin A1C? I thought hemoglobin was what was it carried oxygen in your blood, and I don't understand how that's connected to diabetes. And I'm interested, but the question I wanted to ask before that was, what kind of diabetes are they getting in third world countries? Like, is that also type 1, which I thought was genetic, or is it type 2? And if it is type 2, I was wondering, is there any connection with, like, bacteria, maybe some kind of infection that could be causing it versus diet, because ulcers, I believe, were thought to be, just acid foods a couple of years ago, and then in science it came out, I mean, this was several years ago, maybe 5 years ago, they said it was caused by something, Helicobacter pylorus or something like that. So I was wondering if there might be a microbial connection, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Well, you brought up several good questions there. First of all, to address the question about what is the hemoglobin A1C, it's a blood test. It's a blood test that measures the amount of glucose that is attached to the hemoglobin on the red blood cell. They found that glucose does tend to attach to the hemoglobin, and it stays there on that hemoglobin for the life of the red blood cell, which is about 2 to 3 months. So it's found to be a pretty accurate way to show us how well your diabetes has been controlled over the previous 3 months. Now, there are some factors that can interfere with the hemoglobin A1C. Obviously, if you're anemic or you have a low hemoglobin, you may have a hemoglobin A1C level that looks like it's better than it actually is because there's not enough hemoglobin for all that glucose to attach to. Also, in some type of hemoglobinopathy, such as sickle cell anemia or other types of blood disorders, it may not be accurate. But for the majority of the population, it's now considered kind of the gold standard of what we look at as far as how your diabetes is being controlled overall.
Okay. And the caller was also wondering about, particularly if you look at diabetes in the developing world, is that mostly type 2 diabetes that you say?
Actually, it's both type 1 and type 2 diabetes. And we don't always know all of the causes as far as what causes diabetes. He mentioned possibly a microbial connection. There is some research and some speculation that type 1 diabetes may be triggered by a viral infection. And we also know that in type 1 diabetes, people have positive antibodies. In other words, it's an autoimmune disorder that causes your own body's immune system to attack the cells of the pancreas and destroy them. So that's another factor in type 1 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes tends to have more of a hereditary component sometimes than type 1 diabetes. There's a very strong tendency for type 2 diabetes to run in families. And, of course, it is also associated with diabetes and diet and, you know, sedentary lifestyle, lack of exercise. And we do know that as other countries become more westernized, they have an increase in type 2 diabetes. So certainly the dietary factors are important and play a large role there as well.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Patty Reichard. She is a nurse practitioner, works in the endocrinology department at Carl, and spends a lot of her time working with people with diabetes. So we're here to try to answer questions. I know she will do her best to answer yours. If you have some, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And you can also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Maybe we should just talk at a more basic level about what it is that's happening in diabetes. I guess people get the idea, because we've talked about measuring sugar in the blood, that that's an issue. Mm-hmm. Why is that sugar in the blood? Where does it come from? Why do you get people who have too much in their blood?
Okay. Well, that's a good question, too. The pancreas is very much involved in diabetes, and diabetes is a disorder of the pancreas, and that's a gland that sits kind of behind your gallbladder, behind and just below the stomach. And the pancreas produces various hormones. It has alpha cells, which produce glucagon. It also has beta cells, which produce insulin. And in type 1 diabetes, as I mentioned earlier, something has destroyed those beta cells. It could be a viral infection. It could be an autoimmune process, maybe a combination of the two. But they basically stop functioning, so they stop producing insulin altogether. In type 2 diabetes, it's a more gradual process where usually the body is still producing some insulin from those beta cells, but it gradually decreases over time. And type 2 diabetes can progress over time to the point where the pancreas really isn't producing hardly any insulin anymore. So type 2 diabetes could progress to type 1 over time, because the definition of type 1 is basically when your body doesn't produce any insulin at all. And in type 2, it's producing less insulin than is needed. Now, insulin is very important for glucose metabolism, among other things. But the role of insulin is to transport the glucose that's circulating around in the bloodstream into the cells of the body. So if you don't have enough insulin, then that glucose can't get into the cells of the body, and it stays in the bloodstream and circulates around, and that's where we see an elevated blood glucose level. And that's usually when diabetes is diagnosed, is when that is picked up on a lab test.
So it's just the basic thing is we eat food, it gets digested. One of the results is we get glucose, sugar, which is the energy supply, energy source for the body. It's in the bloodstream. The job of the insulin is to take that and to take it the places where it's supposed to go. But if you don't have enough insulin that to do that, then the sugar level in the blood is just going to continue to build
to be
up,
high.
To be high.
That's correct. And there are a lot of bad things that can happen when you have high levels of blood glucose circulating around for long periods of time. It affects a lot of organs in your body, particularly the small vessels, as well as it can affect the large vessels in your blood, in your body. And so that's where we get into problems with retinopathy, which can affect the small blood vessels in your eyes, and nephropathy or kidney disease. Neuropathy can affect the nerves and cause damage to the nerves. If a person just has diabetes, it increases your risk of heart disease by 50%, or basically doubles your risk of heart disease and other vascular diseases. So the high blood sugar levels are very toxic to the vessels or the lining of the vessels in your body. So that's why we want to avoid that situation.
Yeah. And the problem here is that you can have high blood sugar and it can go on for a long time without having any really obvious symptoms. So there are literally, I guess it's thought to be there are millions of people who are diabetic, who have high blood sugar, who don't know it because it doesn't really produce any symptoms that you would notice. It can go on for a long time without producing any symptoms.
That's true. It's believed that most people have had diabetes for 3 to 5 years. This is type 2 diabetes before it's diagnosed, because with type 2 diabetes, the symptoms do tend to come on more gradually. The main symptoms would be like excessive thirst, excessive urination, possibly fatigue, blurred vision. And you can often explain those kinds of things away. You know, I'm just tired because I've been working hard, or you're drinking a lot of water because you're maybe thirstier. So, of course, you're going to the bathroom more frequently. So it's often, you know, just missed or not picked up until the blood sugar levels get so high that then the symptoms become more severe. Or, like I said, possibly you just go in for a routine exam and they do a blood test and find that the blood sugar levels are elevated.
I guess that would be one of my questions. Is it that people that may indeed be having symptoms and so a doctor may think that that's what's going on and will say, well, let's check your blood sugar level? Or is it that you end up picking up people who have diabetes and maybe, aren't really concerned, or at least they don't have symptoms that they're really concerned about, but that for some other reason, maybe it's a routine physical, maybe there's something else going on, the doctor says, you know, let's take some blood and we're going to check all these various and sundry things. It's probably a long list of stuff that they do. And then one of the things on the list there is blood glucose, is the blood sugar. And they say, well, let's check that too. And then once they do that, the numbers come back and the doctor says, whoa, look at this. We got a problem here.
That's true. That's often the case. Now, with type 1 diabetes, the symptoms tend to come on more dramatically. And often people will end up in the emergency room because they're having so much excessive urination and thirst that they become severely dehydrated. It also is sometimes precipitated by an infection. Usually when you have high blood sugars, you're more prone to infection. So you might get an infection. You go into the doctor's office or the hospital, they do some lab tests and they find that your blood sugars are elevated. But with type 1 diabetes, most people are diagnosed sooner than with type 2 because the symptoms are more dramatic and it usually lands you in the emergency room. With type 1 diabetes, another symptom is rapid weight loss, and sometimes that can be quite dramatic, you know, 20 pounds in 4 weeks or more. You know, that's not unusual to see with undiagnosed type 1 diabetes.
Is there some sort of standard recommendation that everybody should have their blood sugar checked at some point, or do you mostly do that for people who, for whatever reason, you think actually are people who are at risk?
Well, certainly people that are at risk should be checked probably at least annually. That would be people who have a family history of diabetes, who maybe are overweight and sedentary or have other risk factors for diabetes. Women who've had gestational diabetes should be monitored probably yearly, because we know that women who've had gestational diabetes, about 80% will go on to develop type 2 diabetes at some time, maybe, you know, within 5 to 10 years after the pregnancy. So that's a population that I think sometimes we aren't quite as aware of screening as often as we should. But the basic guidelines from the American College of Endocrinologists is to screen all persons for diabetes beginning at age 45. Mm-hmm. And that would just be like with a fasting blood sugar, or the hemoglobin A1C test can now be used for diagnosis of diabetes. The American Diabetes Association just came out with those recommendations in the past year that you could now use the hemoglobin A1C test for diagnosis of diabetes. And that's good because you don't have to be fasting when you go in for that. You don't have to wait around in the lab for 2 hours. The older test we used to use was the 2-hour glucose tolerance test. So just for convenience, that's being used much more frequently for screening as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good because otherwise you have to say to them, we want to check your blood sugar, but you got to go home and you got to come back some other day because you have to not have eaten within the last 8 or 9 hours.
Oh,
it's not 12 hours.
That's
okay.
Correct.
Uh-huh. Because obviously what will happen is if someone mm-hmm. eats and then you take their blood sugar right away, well, it will be high just because of that fact that they were close in time to the last time that they had something to eat. So what you want is you want that to work itself out so that you can get a more kind of baseline reading.
Yes. Well, there are guidelines as to where the blood sugar range should fall, you know, before we would consider it diabetes.
Yeah. And so if someone has their blood sugar checked, what they're going to get back is a number.
Yes.
Right.
Uh-huh.
What does that number tell you, and what number, where do you draw your lines for diabetes, for pre-diabetes, or for basically someone you say, well, you don't have a problem?
Okay. For a fasting blood sugar, and that's when you have been fasting for at least 12 hours, the range for diabetes would be a fasting blood sugar of 126 or greater. And right now, the American Diabetes Association recommends that be repeated so that you have at least 126 or greater 2 times. It doesn't have to be in a row. It could be 2 times over the past 3 years. Mm-hmm. And then that would be enough to qualify as a diagnosis of diabetes. If the fasting blood sugar ranged between 100 and 126, so say 100 to 125, that would be considered impaired fasting glucose, or pre-diabetes is another term. Some people used to call it borderline diabetes. But basically, a normal fasting blood glucose would be less than 100. So anything 100 or greater would be either impaired fasting glucose or diabetes, depending on, you know, where it fell.
Yeah.
125 is kind of the cutoff there.
The pre-diabetes, that's I guess, a more recent term.
Yes.
Maybe, though, the concern was there before, that you had people with a certain level where you'd say, well, we want to be doing some intervention here to see if we can then prevent that person from going on to developing full type 2 diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have someone like that, say someone whose fasting blood sugar is 110, and maybe there's some other things that would cause you to be concerned. Maybe they have family history, or maybe they would say, well, to be honest, I really don't get a lot of exercise, and maybe they're a little bit above their ideal body weight. I mean, you know, those mm-hmm. things that are predisposing. So then with a person like that, what do you start with having them do?
Well, it's very important to intervene at that point and not wait. Mm-hmm. Because there's been a wonderful study done that has shown that it's called the Diabetes Prevention Trial, or DPP for short, that was done several years ago, that showed that if you intervene at that point in pre-diabetes, that you can really prevent and delay the development of that progressing to type 2 diabetes. So it's really important at that point to get in, see a dietitian. At Carle, we have a pre-diabetes class that you can attend. Get involved in, you know, some lifestyle changes, such as doing some regular daily exercise. If you're overweight, if you can lose just, you know, 7 to 10% of your body weight, that can make a tremendous difference. Sometimes that will bring the blood sugars back down into the normal level. And just continue with those interventions. And that, you know, so it's really important not to just say, oh, I'm okay. I'm just have a little bit of sugar, or my blood sugar is just a little bit elevated. But if you're really aggressive at that point, you can do a lot to prevent developing type 2 diabetes, or at least delay it from happening for a number of years.
Yeah, and that's encouraging to know that there are a number of things that people can do mm-hmm. in terms of particularly exercise and diet, far short of before you start getting to talk to people about the possibility of taking medication. There are a lot of other things that you can do to get your blood sugar more under control that are easier once you kind of learn about what the basic idea is, particularly about what you're eating and when and how.
Yes, and there is some controversy right now, but some endocrinologists may recommend starting medication even at that point, perhaps a medication like metformin or glucophage, even in the pre-diabetes range. So we may hear, you know, further guidelines coming out on that in the future, but I've been reading some discussion and there's still it's under debate whether you should start medication at that point or not.
Now, there are people that if their pancreas doesn't make enough insulin, they have to supplement that.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. But for these other medications, what do they do? Is that somehow connected with the insulin production mechanism also?
Do you mean like oral medications
like
for
oral
diabetes?
Medications for diabetes,
Yes, there's various classes of oral medications for diabetes. The one I mentioned, metformin or glucophage, is usually kind of like the first line medication that you often see people started on. And what it does is it helps your body to utilize that insulin that you are making. You have to be making some insulin for it to be effective. So this would be for type 2 diabetes. It helps the glucose to get into the cells a little bit better. It lowers the insulin resistance somewhat so that your own body can utilize that insulin that's on board. It also blocks the liver from sort of dumping out glycogen, which raises the blood sugar at inappropriate times. So it's a very effective drug. It has minimal side effects. It may cause some GI upset, but that usually you can... It improves the longer you take it, if you can stick with it for a while. And it's a fairly safe drug. Then there are other drugs called sulfonylureas, and that would be like glyburide and glipizide. And those are drugs that actually try to push the beta cells in the pancreas to put out more insulin. Hmm. They're called secretagogues, so they basically try to get your own pancreas to produce more insulin. And those can be effective for quite some time, as long as you're still able to, you have enough functioning beta cells to produce extra insulin. The major side effect with these would be low blood sugar or hypoglycemia. So, you know, you need to be sure that you're eating your meals at regular times, not skipping meals. If you're more active, maybe at one time, maybe doing yard work or shoveling snow, increased physical activity, that could cause a low blood sugar to come on with these kind of medications. And there's another class of medications called the TZDs, and that would be one you may have heard of in the news called Avandia and Actos, which there's been a lot of controversy. The FDA did take Avandia off the market for a short period of time, but now it's back on the market with a black box warning. It may increase cardiac problems. And it's not to be given in certain people that have certain types of heart disease. And Actos is being looked at as well. But these can be very beneficial medications because what they do is help lower the body's resistance to insulin. And now there's also a newer class of drugs called the DPP-4 inhibitors, and this would include things like Januvia, or there's a new one out called Victoza, which are oral medications that work with basically there's hormones that are produced in your gut that are also involved in glucose regulation. It's a pretty complicated process. We're finding out it's not just one simple thing, but particularly with type 2 diabetes, you've got at least three different mechanisms going on. But these gut hormones tend to be deficient in people with type 2 diabetes. And their job is to stimulate the pancreas to put out extra insulin in the presence of food. So they're activated when you take that first bite of food and it hits your gut. These hormones then send a message to the pancreas to produce more insulin. And so one of the great advantages of these medications is that there's less opportunity for low blood sugar because it only stimulates the pancreas when you need it, which is when you eat food, whereas the older ones like the sulfonylureas are kind of stimulating the pancreas to put out more insulin all day long. And so if you're not eating food or you go a long period of time without food, it could cause you to have a low blood sugar.
Okay. We have a caller here, someone with a question, and we're a little bit past our midpoint here, so I should introduce again our guest, Patty Reichert. She is a nurse practitioner who works in the endocrinology department at Carl. And in her work, she spends a lot of time working with people who have diabetes, trying to help them manage their condition and answer their questions. And if you have a question about diabetes, give us a call, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free. 800-222-9455. And you can also email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have someone in Sycamore up in the northern part of the state on line four. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. Fascinating discussion also. And I'm wondering if your guest will discuss any activities that are being followed now to try and produce a cure for diabetes, namely inspire the body to develop more of the beta cells that she's referring to, or some other mechanisms. Is there any advancement in that? It seems like all the effort is aimed at managing and treatment rather than cure. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Yes, the American Diabetes Association does have a research arm, and then there's other private research going on in various institutions as well. And I'd like to say we're getting closer to a cure. They are looking at, I've seen some things recently about, looking at this autoimmune process that may be involved with type 1 diabetes. And there are some promising things on the horizon that may interfere with that process if you catch it early enough and be able to reverse that process and then preserve the function of the beta cells somewhat. Not as many promising things out there for type 2 diabetes other than continuing with the lifestyle changes, better diets and things like that. I don't know if you've maybe heard about something called an artificial pancreas. And that's basically kind of a misnomer. A lot of people come into the office and they say they want to get one of these artificial pancreases. But what it is basically it's technology. And we do have this technology in use to a certain extent right now, but it's basically using a insulin pump, which is like a small computer that is attached to your body through a little catheter that goes just underneath the skin, in conjunction with a continuous glucose monitoring device, which is a separate device that you also wear on your body with the little catheter attached just below the skin by a little adhesive. And the glucose monitoring device monitors the level of glucose in that interstitial fluid. It's not the blood sugar. It's the fluid that's circulating there in those tissues. So there is a little bit of difference between that and your blood sugar. And then the insulin pump delivers insulin. And so they're working toward the technology becoming good enough where you can rely on this as a closed system. We're not there yet, but they say we might be about 2 to 3 years away from that, where the continuous glucose monitoring device would remote the information about your blood sugar, you know, minute to minute, to your insulin pump device, and then the insulin pump would deliver the right amount of insulin that you need minute to minute or hour to hour based on that information, and then you would not have to be continuously sticking your fingers and monitoring your blood glucose and making adjustments on your own regarding that. As I said, some people are already wearing the continuous glucose monitoring device and the insulin pump, but they still have to check their blood sugar and do their finger sticks and put that information into the insulin pump themselves. So, you know, that's on the horizon, and that's a very promising technological treatment that's there in the future.
Okay. We have some other callers here, and we have about now 15 minutes left in this part of the show, so we'll get to some other folks and talk next with someone in Mount Zion, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just wanted to share with you that in January will be 50 years my husband has had diabetes. He took me to the doctor with a strep throat, and our doctor was familiar with his mother that had been blind and passed away with diabetes. So I just wanted to share, if you take care of yourself pretty well, and he's up and down like a yo-yo sometimes, but it's just 50 years is a long time.
Well, I appreciate the call. I would hope that people would be encouraged that says that diabetes, if you pay attention to your diet and do the things that your doctor recommends, that it is a manageable condition.
Yeah, it is. I have a sister on the pump, and I have a son on the pump. So we have lots of diabetes in our family.
And that's worked well for them, has it?
Yes. Yes, it has.
Great. Well, thanks very much for the call.
Okay.
I appreciate it. We'll just go on here to Champagne, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, could you say something about the relationship of the food industry to diabetes and what's their responsibility in terms of the amount of sugar that's in everything?
Well, this, I think, I'm glad the caller raises the point, particularly because he mentioned sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I think, gets at an idea that people have that somehow developing diabetes is the result of taking in too much sugar. And I don't think that's right.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. I thought of that earlier, but we didn't get to it yet, that any kind of food that contains carbohydrate eventually gets broken down into glucose when your body digests it and then gets absorbed into the bloodstream as glucose or sugar. So that would be any kind of milk or dairy products, like milk or yogurt. It would be anything like your grains, anything that contains flour, you know, breads, cereals, even good foods like oatmeal, you know, bagels, any kind of rice, pasta, potatoes, beans, peas, corn, all of those are carbohydrates. Even fruits, all kinds of fruit are carbohydrate. So there's certainly, you know, healthier types of carbohydrates and less healthy types of carbohydrate. But they all get broken down into glucose and will raise your blood sugar. So as far as the caller's question about the food industry and what their role is in all this, I'm very encouraged by the fact that a lot of fast food restaurants or chain restaurants are now publishing their nutritional information. And sometimes it's even posted in an obvious place when you go in, such as Panera, I noticed, now has their nutritional information posted as far as how many calories and how many fat grams are in things right on the sign where you're looking at when you're getting ready to place your order. And I would like to see more restaurants and fast food establishments doing that. So then people are enabled to make healthier choices because you can make healthier choices even at McDonald's. So it's all a matter of just the types of foods that you're choosing and then the amounts that you choose at any particular time.
Well, and certainly what the point the caller makes is right on, that one of the things that people need to think about is their total caloric intake, mm-hmm. so how much they're eating, and also how many of those calories come from fat. Because it's certainly the case that we have some issues in this country with heart disease and things like colon cancer, mm-hmm. and diabetes. And in all of those cases, a high-fat diet, particularly high saturated fat, mm-hmm. is implicated in all of those sorts of things. So the same advice goes for any of those things. You want to minimize your risk of those things. Then one of the things that we should be doing is we should be watching how much fat we're taking in.
Yes, fats are just as important as carbohydrates for people with diabetes and for all people, really.
Well, I appreciate the caller's comment. I want to make sure that we talk some more about diet because I'm sure that there are people who maybe have this idea that people who are diabetic have to be on special diets. Maybe they have to eat special food, specially designed and made for people who have diabetes. And while people with diabetes certainly need to pay attention to what they eat, I think it's not a matter of having to eat something special, but just, you know, paying attention to the what are some of the general recommendations for what a healthy diet is.
That's correct. People with diabetes can enjoy all types of foods, but it's certainly going to be to their advantage to, you know, think about how many carbohydrate-type foods you're having at any given time. It doesn't mean that you can't go to a birthday party and enjoy a piece of cake. You just count that as part of your carbohydrates that you're allowed to have for that particular meal or snack. And certainly we don't want to be having cookies and candies and cakes every single day, but it doesn't mean that you can enjoy them. You know, you cannot enjoy them at all just because you have diabetes.
And is it also the case, do I understand this, that particularly that fiber has a beneficial role here? So the kind of things that were recommended, that it's good to be thinking about trying to have a good amount of fiber in your diet for a variety of reasons, also is good for trying to maintain a kind of a level, stable blood sugar throughout the day?
Yes, fiber can be very important with diabetes because the types of carbohydrate foods that are higher in fiber, like your whole grain breads and cereals and your fresh fruits and vegetables that have more fiber, it takes your body longer to break that fiber down into glucose. So it doesn't raise your blood sugar quite as quickly after you've consumed the higher fiber foods. And they have what we call a lower glycemic index. So there's actually a rule that our dietitians give people that if a food has over a certain number of grams of fiber, which is, I think it's above 7 or 8 grams of fiber, you can actually subtract 7 or 8 from the number of carbohydrate grams that you're consuming, whatever that fiber number is, because of that lower glycemic index. Yeah.
So it is true, though, that people who have diabetes and are trying to manage that condition, they do have to pay maybe a little bit more attention than a lot of people do to what it is they're eating?
Absolutely. Yes. And what you're eating is very important when you have diabetes. And that's probably one of the most difficult changes you have to make when you have been given the diagnosis of diabetes, is getting used to just having to focus on your food, thinking about it a little bit more, and just trying to maintain that healthy diet.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones here and talk with someone in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering what the connection was between how much you eat and what you eat, because I was under the impression that fats, the normal fat that they talk about, like, you know, polyunsaturated, saturated, those are triacylglycerides. And so I know when they get broken apart, you end up with a glycerol molecule and then the fatty acids. And the glycerol, I was under the impression, can be converted in the liver into glucose. So I don't know if someone has diabetes and they're dealing with it, do they need to not just watch what they eat, but really do need to be careful about how much they eat more than other people? I don't know, just a comment on that.
Yes, how much you eat is very important. And we really recommend that all people go see a dietitian when you're diagnosed with diabetes, and possibly even, you know, once a year, every year, just to check in with a dietitian, because things change over time. And it's really the registered dietitian's role to determine, you know, exactly how many carbohydrates you should be consuming with each meal, and how much fat and how many calories. And they can help work with you, you know, to come up with a meal plan and a healthy diet plan. But you mentioned the role of fats. That is generally very important in people with diabetes, because we did mention that people with diabetes are more prone to heart disease. Also, people with diabetes often have what we call dyslipidemia, or in other words, you may have higher triglyceride levels and lower levels of the good cholesterol. So then, you know, we're interested in the types of fats that you're consuming to try to improve that situation. So it's all connected, you know, fats, carbohydrates, and the best way to really determine you know, what you as an individual should be doing as far as a healthy diet, a healthy meal plan, is to consult with a registered dietitian.
Okay, yeah. Mm. I appreciate that. My wife had gestational diabetes with her last child. Mm-hmm. And she got a consultation with a dietitian. And, you know, it's hard if you're the only one doing it. So we both followed her diet, and it was, I didn't get tested. So, I mean, maybe I have diabetes, who knows, but I don't think I did. I mean, I don't have any problems, but it was definitely beneficial for me as well to kind of go along with her. So I think I could just kind of the comment that something we experienced, that earlier caller gave a comment about her family. You know, for anyone else who's listening, it is really helpful if it's a familial thing, if everybody in the family can try and kind of eat the same thing, because makes it easier on the person who's got something to control if the people next to them aren't eating Pringles, potato chips, and stuff like that.
Yeah, I'm sure also makes the business of meal planning a lot easier, too.
It sure did. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's go to Champaign County now for another caller here. This is line three. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to ask you about A1C, the test that you mentioned earlier, and I've had my doctor explain it to me before. I don't know how much time there's left, but also as a follow-up, you seem to imply that there's no research that shows that, you know, a lot of sugar, a lot of insulin shock, or pre-insulin shock, that this doesn't do something to deteriorate the pancreas, Ilse of Langerhans or whatever they're called, that that there's no relation between our sugar-bound culture and the proliferation of diabetes. I mean, it's kind of folkloric that eating sugar causes diabetes. You're saying that it doesn't, or you're implying that it doesn't. Is that substantiated, I mean, in research? Because just looking at the culture, I mean, the earlier question asked about who's responsible. Well, putting that aside, isn't there research that shows that longitudinally that using a lot of sugar causes atrophy of something that helps us stabilize and might lead to diabetes? So there's two questions there, and I don't know how much time you really have.
But. Well, we have a couple of minutes. I'm glad. I think maybe I was the one who made the suggestion that eating sugar didn't matter, and I think that was something that I read now. And if that's not correct, let's make sure that we correct that. So what is the connection? Is there a connection between eating a lot of refined sugar? So that would be, you know, eating a lot of candy bars and things like that, as opposed to, you know, eating a lot of fruit. And maybe that could be an issue too. But what is there a connection between high sugar, eating a lot of sugar in your diet, and the potential for developing diabetes?
Well, certainly eating a lot of sugar in your diet could lead to obesity and being overweight, and there is a very strong connection with obesity and type 2 diabetes. There may be a misconception out there that if you consume a lot of sugar, this can cause you to have diabetes. I'm not aware of any research that indicates that link, although there may be indirect links. I don't know that there's a direct link between just consuming a lot of sugar and then, you know, you turn up with diabetes. It's not always clear cut because, as I mentioned earlier, there's a number of different factors that are coming into play together that result in diabetes being diagnosed. But certainly, everyone can benefit by having a healthier diet. And certainly the deterioration in the American diet has a great deal to do with the obesity epidemic and the increase in the development of diabetes as it's increasing every year. So I don't want to say that that's not important. It certainly is important. But I'm just not aware of a direct link. Generally, you know, there's going to be some tendency underlying toward diabetes, either through a family history or through the obesity or being overweight, that would have to come into play along with that high consumption of glucose in order for a person to develop diabetes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And maybe the caller was interested in possibly having you talk a little bit more about the blood test that we mentioned earlier, that this is a different sort of blood test to check blood sugar that does something a little bit different. And as you explained, maybe the advantage of this blood test is that you can do it any time. The person doesn't mm-hmm. have to be fasting to do it.
Yes. We talked about earlier what the hemoglobin A1C is actually measuring is the amount of glucose that's attached to the red blood cell. And we know it stays with that red blood cell for about 2 to 3 months. So it tells us what your blood sugars have been averaging over the previous about 2 to 3 months. The number that we go by for diagnosing diabetes, if it's used to diagnose diabetes, is 6.5 or greater, is what the American Diabetes Association has come out with in the past year to say that if you go into your doctor's office and you're just having a routine, say a physical exam, and you have a family history of diabetes, so there's some concern about that, and you haven't been fasting that day, he or she could have you just go to the lab, get a hemoglobin A1C test, and if it's 6.5 or greater, the American Diabetes Association now says that could be considered a diagnosis of diabetes. There's still some controversy about that. They're still debating it a little bit because of there are other factors that come into play there, like, you know, anemia or other blood disorders that could interfere with that number as well.
Do you just real quick now, because of the concerns about the prevalence of type 2 diabetes in children and adolescents, do you think it's going to be recommended now that you start screening blood sugar for people? I think you talked earlier about what the standard age was now for when you want to check somebody. Is it now you think we're going to start screening more kids and adolescents?
Yes, they have come out with guidelines, I think, through the American Academy of Pediatrics as well as the American Public Health Association now as far as screening children. And certainly if they have certain risk factors, that should prompt a screening or a test for diabetes in, you know, children that are their BMI, which is a measure of their body mass index, is over a certain level. And they should be screened. Plus, if there are any symptoms of diabetes, you know, such as excessive thirst, excessive urination, frequent infections, things like that, rapid weight loss, those would certainly prompt a screening for diabetes as well.
All right. There, we'll have to stop with our thanks to our guest, Patty Reichert. She's a nurse practitioner, works in the endocrinology department at Carle. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.